Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A very warm welcome to the listeners of our Care in Action podcast, the podcast of Care Austria. And as I open it many times, but today I have a really very special guest. A warm welcome to Dr. Musonda Mumba. Hi, Musonda. Glad that you are here with us.
Thank you, Andrea, and thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm excited.
It's our pleasure. Before we start our conversation, I will give a very short introduction of our today's guest. Our guest, as I said, is Dr. Musonda Mumba, the Secretary General of the Ramsar Convention of Wetlands. She was born in Zambia. She grew up there and she grew up amid so-called vibrant African ecosystems where wetlands were lifelines also for her community. And even as a child, this was already sparking a passion that later led to her studies, to her PhD in wetland conservation, and over 25 years experience in leading global efforts at UNEP, UNDP, and now Ramsar. We will talk about that very soon. She's also the founder of the Network of African Women Environmentalists, NAVE. And this network is empowering women in a male-dominated field and was named one of the world's top women restoring the planet. So you see, we have a very interesting guest today. And I would like to go back at the beginning to your childhood in Zambia. So we heard that you saw the beauty, but also the fragility of the ecosystem there. Was your passion for wetlands already sparked as a child?
Now, thank you so much for that question. So to just put this in context for people that may not know where Zambia is. So, you know, Zambia is in Southern Africa and we have 8 other countries that border. So we're a landlocked country. And so I was born very close to the border with what is today now Congo DRC, Democratic Republic du Congo, which was Zaire. And as a kid in the 70s and 80s, you can imagine, you know, playing outside. We had no gadgets or anything. And literally, my siblings and I, we grew up about less than 100 meters from a river. Mm-hmm. So we were, our family home was literally in the midst of the town and very close to the Mansa River. So I'd go and swim with children, other children and friends and my twin sister. And really hanging out. But at the same time, my grandparents also ran a business in a region, which is one of, you know, Zambia's largest wetland systems in the Bangweulu. So I thought it was just normal going, you know, to these places, eating the fish and my family on the family table talking about, oh yeah, you know, your grandfather's boat went over there and this beautiful wetlands and this beautiful marshes. And then my grandmother would talk about, you know, the swallows in the sky, which I had no idea, you know, why these birds were, where they were coming from and where they were arriving, that the arrival of the swallows meant that the rainy season was close. So I didn't realize that these birds had migrated thousands of kilometers away and really coming to be in wetlands and thrive and breed and all of that. So this, you know, system, this knowledge system, this passion and this interest around nature was already something I saw in my family and in my community, but also with the food that we ate. You know, there's this really wonderful food called chikanda, which is it I don't know how to define it. It almost tastes a bit like a salami, but actually it's made from an orchid, and this orchid comes only from wetlands. So already we were eating this food, which I did not even realize that this orchid is pretty rare until I was a wetland ecologist and I was working on wetland systems and food systems and really realizing that, wow, all of this connectivity, all of this knowledge that is around me that was very much connected to wetlands in an everyday way. And that also kind of inspired me to become what I eventually became as an ecologist.
And we have already heard that this is a still male-dominated field like so many others. So obviously your family was very encouraging you, and it was not such a big issue for you as a girl not only to go to school, but also have this higher education, reach your PhD. Obviously, you were already very empowered by your family as well. Is that true?
Absolutely. So, you know, when we're young, my grandfather passed away. And my grandmother was running the family business. I mean, she was the matriarch, and she was so instrumental in making sure that all the young women get an education. I mean, she invested in education. Our family business was very well known even to this day. And so for me, I saw the strong women. And there's a picture in our family home, which has a picture of my grandmother with all men on the picture. And she's sitting in a corner. And she's the only woman in the picture. And I thought that was normal. I thought it was very normal. I'm like, okay, she's in the picture with all these men, you know. Mm-hmm. And later on, when I investigated, it was a conversation where she was negotiating with the members, because she was a local leader in the community. She was negotiating about owning one of the prime properties in the town because she was a widow. And it was extremely fascinating. So for me, I already saw these powerful women in place. And then I also have my mother was South African, and my late South African grandmother was, you know, she came into Zambia as in exile from South Africa because of apartheid. But she was a trained nurse who talked very, very much about all these injustices and all of this. And I was like, okay, this is normal. Until I was much older to realize that these women were inspiring me and my twin sister. And my father was also extremely instrumental in inspiring us as girls, because there's nothing is impossible. Nothing is impossible. And I remember at a family reunion, we were talking, and I wanted to be a medical doctor because I thought that was so cool. You know, they're wearing white mm-hmm. coats in the hospital. And I say to my uncle, you know, it was a big reunion. And I said, you know, I want to be a doctor. And then he said, oh, do you mean a nurse? And my dad turns and says, no, you heard her right. You really heard her correct. She said doctor. And that for me really said, oh my goodness, my dad is like this champion, this feminist, this man was like, go, 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 be what you want to be. And that for me was something where I just did not see any impossibility ahead of me, because I had this all these inspiring people around me.
Thanks for sharing this rather private insight, because this is exactly where the work of CARE also comes in. I'm sure you have heard about it, that CARE is globally focusing on working with women and girls. And what I have heard very many times, and what was also the case in my case, is that you need an encouraging family ecosystem to really become successful later. The family has really to pay attention to the education of boys and girls, but also of girls, and encouraging them really to reach the highest levels. This is still an issue also, as you see for sure also in the European societies. This is still an issue. We talk about everything is equal, and of course we have different possibilities. I mean, just to mention it, in Austria, women were allowed to start studying at university after 1900, some years after that. Yeah. So it was not common. Many were special listeners to the courses they were interested, without being officially accepted as students. So I think this is a very relevant setting that you shared, that you need female role models, you need them, but you also need male encouragement, right? It's a combination of both.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm. And for today, I would say that you are one of the role models, right, when it comes to fighting the impact of climate change and being a real environmentalist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know what's interesting. So after I studied what I studied, and also going back to the region where I was born, because I was in Zambia, but also seeing the dynamics happening in Zambia, I noticed that, you know, these changes in these wetland systems, these very complex dynamics. And I was trying to understand, okay, why are we getting more invasive species? Why is there less water? And what is the intersection of, you know, degradation, once degradation happens in an ecosystem, mm-hmm. and what are the impacts on communities? And remember, I spoke about this food, this plant orchid called chikanda. It's mm-hmm. women that harvest this particular plant. And so over time, I realized there was less and less and less, and it became very expensive in markets. And the women would say, look, we can't find it over here because, you know, the trees were cut over there. And this section has been degraded. And this is something that I even saw when I worked as a UN diplomat in many different parts of the world, where when degradation happened to ecosystem, particularly wetlands, the first point of challenge started with the women and children, and particularly with droughts. And so the manifestation of droughts also shows up very evidently in wetlands, because a wetland by nature is supposed to be wet.
Mm-hmm. And allows you to do some agriculture and to produce food and sustainable food. And this is the right moment in this podcast to mention that over 300 million at the moment of people on our planet have not enough to eat. They are food insecure. And this is quite a lot. And the tendency is unfortunately growing. And mm-hmm. the answer to this can't be in the long run only to build it on humanitarian aid, because this should be nothing that is lasting forever. This is only a quick emergency bridge to survive. But what we see more and more, being the CEO of CARE in Austria and representing us in a global forum where we talk about emergency aid, the challenges are too big. So we need some solutions and some protect and a lot of protection of wetlands, which are often overlooked, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll give some examples very quickly. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember in the sort of mid-2000s when that flood happened in Mozambique. Mm-hmm. Now, my PhD was focused on the Kafue River, which is a big tributary to the Zambezi River. And the Zambezi as a system has several dams, big hydrological dams. One of them is the Kariba Dam, which generates electricity for Zambia and Zimbabwe. And then further down is the Cahorabasa. The Cahorabasa Dam is the one that's in Mozambique to provide electricity to Mozambique. Now, this level of regulation in rivers basically reduces the amount of water in the floodplain downstream. So the Zambezi enters the Indian Ocean in a beautiful wetland system called Maromeo in Zambezia. Now, Maromeo is where, when those freak rains of 2002, 2003 happened, we saw how, and further it meant several years, this flooding of these floodplain areas. There was a very dramatic picture of a woman giving birth in a tree. And I think CNN was, everybody was talking about the ethical nature of that, you know, is it CNN, is it BBC? I cannot remember. But the woman was in the tree because she was running away from the floods. The water was rising. By the very nature, floodplains, the water rises, right? But people had been using this place for agriculture for years because not enough water was happening. So to your point on the humanitarian side, I think what has happened in places like Mozambique is this conversation of how do we have these early warning mechanisms, mm-hmm. even within wetland systems, but also how do we build an element of resilience, particularly mm-hmm. in fragile ecosystems like wetlands, which tend to be fertile because women are trying to grow food, but also very susceptible to change, mm-hmm. extremely susceptible to extreme rainstorms, and all of that. So we work, obviously, as a convention, for example, particularly Mozambique and many other countries work with, WWF, the World Conservation Organization, which you know, Wetlands International, which is a Dutch-based international organization, and many other partners and local partners and the humanitarian sector to really talk about how do we have a whole of society approach to minimize impacts, but also manage wetlands better for people. Because we have realized, and very recently, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, we launched this Global Wetland Outlook, where we talked about what is the cost of losing a wetland, mm-hmm. or what is the cost of having a damaged ecosystem to people, mm-hmm. but also to women in particular, and mm-hmm. to sort of, you know, younger people in a community who are more fragile and usually not economically capable of really thriving and surviving in this, you mm-hmm. know, very dilapidated and very degraded space.
So I would like to highlight some of the aspects that you mentioned, also from a point of view of care. Some of our appreciated listeners might think, why is it so important, especially to women and girls? Because in many African settings and societies, they are the main food producers, small-scale agriculture, and many women and girls are the main food producers for their families and their communities. So this is one of the important points. The second one is that CARE Austria in particular, but CARE is one of the most important partners when it comes to humanitarian aid for Mozambique for many, many years. We have been working in Mozambique and also in the field of what we summarize under resilience building. So how can we strengthen the resilience of a local community to have sustainable income and survival and better agriculture for the needs of their environment, especially under the impact of climate change, which is an additional layer of complexity to what we were talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And finally, I couldn't highlight it more that because it shouldn't sound now in this conversation between two very privileged women, because you have a very super interesting job, I have a good interesting job, and we are talking here about really basics and million of people literally in this minute are struggling to survive. Yeah. So in our positions, we take it very seriously that, of course, our organizations bring a certain level of expertise to the table, but the main players and the main decision makers are always locally grounded. I assume this is also the case with the work of the Ramsar Convention, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So this is also why, Andrea, you know, a year ago, when I was in the second year of my tenure as Secretary General, and remember, I used to be an intern at the convention in 1998.
I have read that. Yeah.
Yeah. In 1998. So coming back, this is a very full circle moment for me. I've gone around the world and had a really and very fortunate and privileged career. And then I returned to the convention here in Switzerland. So, and at the same time, I've been very fortunate to have this vantage point of entering different spaces and different countries around the world and seeing what is experienced and what is happening. So one of the things that I realized, and this is also goes back a little bit to my reflections and my experience in the past, was that every time I read documents or I read publications about wetlands, they never talk about the women that work mm-hmm. around wetland issues. So one of the campaigns that we started in the convention was called Women in Wetlands, Change Makers in their communities. And I literally, you know, challenged my team. I said, let's go out there and find these women anywhere in the world. Who are they at the political level? Who are they at the community level? Who are they in the scientific level or in the innovation level? Oh my goodness, it's been phenomenal, phenomenal. And we're happy to share that information with you, so that you can share it with your constituency. Mm-hmm. What was amazing was, one of the women, for instance, is, Sybille Vermont, who's Swiss. She has been super impressive in the sense that, not only was she, the negotiator for Switzerland, she's had a very long career in the water world, but also has been in, similar to me, very male-dominated environment, talking about conversations around wetlands, around climate change, around all these different issues. And I watched her negotiate, and I watched her talk about these complexities and some of the policies that are problematic for communities and women. And I was like, whoa. But then I also realized that she was the bridge builder between our convention to also the United Nations, because we are not in the UN system. So we're now connected to the UN Water Convention as a water convention, to talk about these issues and how water is very central to communities and to life and to health and all of that. I was just blown away. And then another woman, is a woman from El Salvador. Her name is Lina Paul. I've actually never met Lina, but we have communicated and been in touch when I was in the UN. Now, Lina used to be the Minister of Environment of El Salvador, and she did something phenomenal. She presented a resolution at the General Assembly in 2018, to talk about, let's have a decade on ecosystem restoration. And for her coming from, you know, an Amazonian kind of environment, yeah, she's like, look, something has gone wrong on the planet. The systems are degraded. The systems have been controlled. You live on the Danube. You know, this system is very controlled. The system is modified. And so when climate change happens, or when extreme events happen, like what happened last year with the floods in Vienna, how do we restore these spaces to an almost close to natural environment? Mm-hmm. You know, it was phenomenal. She presented this, had many countries support her. September of 2018, 1st of March 2019, the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration was born.
Mm-hmm. Which is really amazing.
Nobody realizes that it took a woman to actually champion this topic. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Austria a year ago, I was blown away because I was on the Danube working with many people from the Austrian government, because we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the convention in Austria. Yeah. The amount of restoration that's happening on the Danube is impressive.
It's enormous, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal, because of the learning and realizing what we've done to Mother Nature.
Yeah, I think we have all made quite a journey, and we now see that the beliefs that we had when the two of us were children, because when I was a child, everything was regulated. Every river, every small river was put in a concrete bed and everything was regulated. Nowadays, we spend millions to re-naturate our rivers and areas again. I mean, Vienna's position at the Danube was always quite privileged historically already, because the Danube is not in the city center like in Bratislava or in so floodings were not too bad in Vienna. And we have now this extra regulation basin built, I think it was in the 60s or 70s, if I remember correctly, where flooding is not happening any longer in Vienna with the Danube. But you are totally right. We live very close to a very exploited ecosystem, and we take it somehow for granted. Mm-hmm. It's normal that it's there and we take it for granted, right? Mm-hmm. And what I also want to highlight, because you shared the valuable contributions of two very impressive women like yourself. And what we need is meaningful participation for women. This was for me a very good example. We also, as an organization like CARE, we focus, of course, on the so-called, I don't like the expression, grassroots level. What does that mean? But of course, we include all the farmers, all the small-scale farmers, all the people living in remote areas, also in Mozambique. Mm-hmm. But we have to enable more women and girls to participate meaningfully at all levels. And not just sitting at the table as a woman with all educated people, and they don't dare to raise their voice because they simply are not well equipped for it. Mm-hmm. So I think the examples that you've shared and that we are sharing today really highlight the relevance and importance of good education and access to good education and information, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Super. So let's talk a little bit about that's your specialty, not mine, but I will ask you the question. So from my perspective, and in many of the podcasts, this is a topic that we see at the moment, or not at the moment, we have seen in the last years a real loss in biodiversity, also in the so-called development industrialized countries. This is due to conflicts, pollution, and many other things. First point. Second point, I don't think that many people are aware of that, that wetlands are able to store more carbon than forests. I'm not saying that we don't need forests anymore, but this is a pro for protecting wetlands because they are good carbon storages. And your convention, Musonda, the Ramsar Convention, pushes for so-called wise use of wetlands. What do you exactly mean with that?
Right. So let me just take you a little bit to our history. So our history as a convention, we were born in 1971. So we had the first ever multilateral environmental agreement. And so the visionaries
in Iran, right? Ramsar is the city where it was signed in Iran, no?
Correct. So I'll give a little bit of history.
Yeah,
so
please.
One of the founders actually, and the main sort of initiator of all of this, was the Swiss, ecologist, Luc Hoffmann, Dr. Luc Hoffmann. He was a zoologist. So Luc, went and settled in the Camargue, in Arles, in the town of Arles, and he saw how in the Camargue, this beautiful wetland system, all these birds that would come in and migrate in this region, coming all the way from Russia and back, you know, so this migratory pathway. And he was working a lot with hunters. And hunters were like, look, we're seeing this decline, talking about biodiversity loss, because the hunters are observers.
Yeah.
And they know that, okay, no. We're not going to continue doing this because the population is a lot less and we wait. So I think hunters are some of the most patient individuals. So the hunters were the ones that were raising the flag. You know, we've seen this bird and we've seen that bird and da, 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 da. We need to do something about it. And Luke was like, okay, hang on. But the birds that you're talking about actually are all coming into wetlands. What is the state of the wetland? So he started asking around because it was a network of European wetlands. Okay, what's happening in Poland? What's happening in Austria? What's happening
everywhere.
In Germany? Everywhere. So now everybody's writing each other letters and says, oh, actually, we haven't seen the stork in so many years. What?
Yeah.
And so people began to realize there was a correlation between, for instance, in Germany and also parts of Austria, this extraction of peat for energy.
Yeah.
So you extract peat. Now, peat wetland systems are the most also carbon-dense ecosystems. So now you want to extract peat, but to extract peat, you have to drain the wetland.
Mm-hmm.
You drain it, make sure it's very dry, and then you take the peat and then use it for energy and all of that. Now, these are very diverse spaces where there are insects, there are amphibians, mm-hmm. and birds, when they're migrating, find this place. So the conversation started to come and pop up. How do we use these spaces wisely? So when this terminology was put within the actual core principles of the convention in 1971, they all gathered and said, okay, let's find a place where we can all be a little bit neutral and identify a location where we can sign this agreement. And they all traveled to Ramsar in Iran in 1971.
Yeah.
And the agreement was signed. But there was a lot. It was a culmination of conversations way back when in the 60s, when there was this realization that you are degrading spaces. But because wetlands are also human interacted spaces,
mm-hmm.
is the conversation was, how do we use them wise? Before the word sustainability was even born, the word wise use was at the table. So this has been a part of the conversation for our convention now, 50 plus years on, to now discuss how do we, what is wise use? How wise is wise? And how sustainable is sustainable? So to just give another very quick example. So part of the wise use principle, in a case like in Cameroon, one of the women that we recognize, Cecile Njebet, she works with many women in the mangrove systems. Now, mangroves are very fish rich.
Mm-hmm.
They're shrimp rich.
Mm-hmm.
They are just amazing and beautiful, but they're also very carbon rich. extremely, they're carbon sequestering ecosystems. Now she realized, Cecile realized, when we recognized her, we started to talk to her, what is happening in your country? What is happening in other places that you're working in the Congo Basin, particularly in the mangroves? She says, you know what? Women are the ones who work with the fisher folk and sometimes even go into the sea and get the fish and everything, but they're also smoking the fish. Now, smoked fish is a multi-million dollar industry in Central and West Africa because dried fish is the source of protein for many communities, and it's part of the nutrition, part of culture, part of rituals and everything. And she realized that women were cutting the mangrove wood to smoke the fish.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, no, hang on. So how are you actually cutting the very source of your fish? You're destroying the very wetlands. So let us figure out another way. We plant some woodlots of other trees that are fast growing and potentially local trees so that you can use those trees in a very rotational way to smoke the fish while the mangrove recovers. And it was phenomenal to really have this. So this is also an example of how do we use a system wisely? Because it's the system that's feeding you. It is the system that's keeping the carbon content on the planet low. It is the system that is also sheltering you from potential disasters in the case of a storm. And these multiple layers, and this is really the very essence of this convention. How do we do things wisely, use our spaces wisely?
And this approach was taken decades before the buzzwords of today, like sustainability and climate impact and things like that, have even existed in our minds. But it also shows wisely includes economy, community, and also a global interest. So when we too now talk about the fisherwoman in West Africa, we could have the same conversation about fisherwomen in Vietnam and how they protect their, how they have to learn to protect mangrove forests. Also, they are good protection for flooding, like you said. So the wise use includes social, climate, and economical interests, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because this is something I wanted to ask you because you told us in the beginning that your grandmother run a business. So you had right from the beginning in your young life, you were exposed to business life and what is necessary to have a successful business. Because I'm really convinced, even as the CEO of an NGO, I'm convinced, yes, we have to fight back the climate change. Yes, we have to change, but there has to be a visible intersection also with economic interests that people can recognize and can follow. And we have to provide lots of education, like to the fisherwomen. This is the simpler part, not to destroy their own ecosystem. Even with very educated people, you find some who are destroying their own ecosystem when doing intensive farming with glyphosate or things like that. Yeah. So. I think that your convention really is very progressive and also very rational in many ways, because it shouldn't be one extreme or the other, like we had it very often in the past, right?
No, absolutely. And I think for me, this is where you see the element of, I wouldn't want to say the element of utility, it's the element of interaction with nature. But how do you interact with nature? And you rightly said, you know, you remember 2004, the tsunami hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Last year in July, I was in Bali and I was invited by His Excellency President Widodo, the former president of Indonesia, to visit a nursery of mangroves. He's a mangrove forester. And I asked him, I said, Your Excellency, what happened in Banda Aceh? If you remember the
yes,
vision.
Yes, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was devastating. Mm. Extremely devastating. He just said a few words. He said, Dr. Musonda, I want to tell you that what happened in Banda Aceh was that we got rid of all the mangroves. So the shield, the protection layer for the city, for the town,
vanished.
Mm-hmm. And then I met one or two survivors of the tsunami from Sri Lanka who told me the reason we were saved was because the mangroves were there. I was like, oh my goodness. So you begin to interact with these individuals and women in particular who tell you just the disappearance of my town. I lost my job. I lost my family. I lost my livelihood. I lost everything. And now I have to rebuild from scratch and I'm trying to figure out. And I want to say something that also is very interesting. I used to be, when I worked for United Nations Environment Program, I used to be the focal point on mountains globally in the world. And I remember coming to Vienna. Actually, I went to another town not far from Salzburg where I was speaking at an event organized by women in Austria about women in mountains. And what I found very fascinating is that even, you know, we talk about making sure that women are empowered, they have access to, you know, economic access, et cetera, and also have their own financial stability. But you also realize that sometimes the tenure systems are problematic. So the tenure system, one of the ladies was telling me like, oh, listen, I mean, the land in the Alps can never be subdivided. So if it belongs to my grandfather, it belongs to my grandfather. So it does not belong to me. I cannot own it. And so sometimes it's so difficult for me to be able to justify why I have to reinvest money in there because of this tenure system. And I say to them, I said, well, what you're describing is also something that I have seen for women in many parts of Africa. Yeah. And I'm very fortunate because I'm one of the few women across the continent and now growing masses of women that actually own land, which was never the case. But systemically, you know, sometimes the certain policies also undermine. And one of the things I realized over time, even with the restoration of damaged wetlands, some of these wetlands actually are on private land. And we've gone to communities and to women and said, okay, you know, you need to plant so many plants and you need to mount so many trees. And the woman looks at you as like, I don't own the land. It belongs to my husband. Why should I invest in this planting so many trees? And by the way, a tree doesn't grow in 3 days. It's going to grow in God knows how many years. And I could even be divorced. And then I lose everything I have invested. So what is the incentive for me to actually be an equal contributor to this structural complexity and this system? So I can imagine that even, you know, how you work in care, you begin to see this at the very bottom of society.
And it's a cumbersome way and cumbersome thing to be highly educated, well-informed, and to meaningfully participate, right? And not all of our sisters, let's put it like that, are willing to follow this path. We see also in a traditional country like Austria, we see a certain backlash when it comes to feministic topics. That young women say, I don't want to be a feminist. For us, it was normal. We were proud when we grew up to say, of course, I'm a feminist.
No, absolutely. I mean, backlash is there for sure.
The backlash is there, and it is. And I think the issues that we have to deal with after 30 years in this sector, they are much closer together. It's not any longer you in Africa, we in Europe. It's all the same. We are debating the same things, maybe in different levels, but still, we have to find global solutions. So, what I want to ask you. Not the final question, but one of our last points of discussion. I'm deeply convinced that only global collaboration can help us solve problems. Now we are very much exposed to very powerful new tools. Let's call them artificial intelligence, knowing that there are many, many different tools that we are talking about. And I have already had some guests in this podcast series where we talked about the fact that especially in African settings, but also in other global settings, parts of some river systems are unmapped.
Yes. Still, yes.
Yeah. And do you think that these new tools that are now penetrating our daily life, more or less, and our working life, can help us become more efficient, a bit faster?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So remember, I told you that in July, I was in Vienna. And the reason I came to Vienna was because us as a convention, together with the European Space Agency, we're signing a memorandum of intent to continue to work together to formalize our relationship. We've already been working with EZA for over 20 years, but we were formalizing that relationship. And then at our convention's conference of the parties, which was happening in July this year, the 15th session of it, in Zimbabwe, there was a resolution which was adopted on wetland inventories, encouraging governments to even integrate artificial intelligence, satellite data, and also use of drones in monitoring. Now, imagine places like the Amazon that are dense and very difficult to access. Same with the Congo Basin, same with places in like Borneo, even in some very dense islandic spaces. The only way you can actually monitor a lot of these places, and now the technology is very advanced. You're measuring the depth of the water, you're measuring the actual temperature dynamic to even know the vegetation cover that is there. And this for us is extremely helpful. But that does not also replace traditional knowledge, because in places like the Amazon, you know, indigenous peoples know how to sense the nature. They know how to sort of get a sense, okay, if we hear this bird or we hear this sound, that means that something has vanished. And then complemented by the satellite data, for sure, a satellite image can say, oh, you're right, that wetland we thought was there has disappeared. Oh, what happened? Okay, there's been a drainage and there's been a dredging and now there's a new dam and blah, blah. Because most of these places are remote. So for us as a convention, the use of these new technologies for sure are helping this very diverse conversation. Mm-hmm. But also because we're the convention of wetlands and waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
So we believe, because we support all these different flyways. You know, I was in Mach Egg in Austria, and I remember seeing the Schloss there, and there were these big, massive empty nests. And the gentleman I was with was like, oh yeah, the birds have just left. They've just, you know, they've left. And they have this beautiful map on the wall that tells you the migration pathway. A few months later, I was in Nairobi, Kenya. Uh-huh. And then one of the guys from the Kenya Wildlife Service said, oh, we've just received these storks that have, because they're now monitoring together with the Austrian government. Yeah. Oh, they just arrived in Nairobi. I was like, whoa.
So we have really real life flight data of the storks moving from Austria to Kenya and vice versa. Isn't that amazing somehow?
It's phenomenal. Yeah. And then they were like, oh yeah, they're just about to leave because they're heading to Cape Town. Now remember, in other places, there was a story actually, I think it was in 2020, was it in 2023 or 2022, just around the time of COVID, there was a report of a bird, which was called the Bartel Godwit, which flew from Alaska 30,000 kilometers nonstop. Now, the Bartel Godwit, for both the people of Alaska and the people in New Zealand, the indigenous peoples, there are even ceremonies of receiving these sentient creatures, you know, the receiving of the birds. Yeah. And even though these communities may never would have communicated in the past,
now they can.
Exactly. You know, here you are with a device, you've got a phone, and you can download an app and say, oh, we can see where it is now.
And wow. This is all very fascinating. And as a cultural anthropologist by training, I think that one of the future and current roles of organizations like CARE will be to be bridge builders to between traditional society or people who live in remote areas, and also providing access to these modern tools and to really see how we can connect this for the benefit of human societies together. Because of course, there are a lot of disadvantages as well, but we should focus on the good things we can do with these tools and how they can help us and also you and Ramsar and the very important wetlands and waterfall convention, how to use our resources wisely, because what we know for sure, they are limited.
No, absolutely, absolutely. So you know, the counting of species, for instance, and that's why I referenced Mach Egg. So there's a team there that counts the number of storks that have returned and, you know, the bred and the number. So we can tell from the populations, is this increasing or is it decreasing? And this is why, and you were talking about the issue of collaboration. This is why for us as a convention, we collaborate with many different other conventions and other partners. For instance, we work very closely with the convention, the Minamata Convention, which focuses on mercury and other pollutants, because part of the challenge of the decline of these species is because the state of a wetland somewhere is so degraded, it's so bad, that a bird that left Austria very healthy lands in another location and gets sick and cannot go back. And then you're realizing this decline. You're like, okay, what exactly happened somewhere? And so this is why our convention, when we come together, this conversation to say, look, the state of wetland in your country matters for the state of wetland in another. We have to work together, but not only just for these particular species, even for human health. This matters if the wetland is not healthy, if the wetland is not better, if the wetland is not in a way that it's giving us all these other services. It's extremely, extremely important that we are all on the same table and we're all also of the same level of understanding of what we should be doing also for our human well-being. So that in itself, and remember, there's been a lot of conversations about spending more time in nature, especially around water and the role of mental health and all of that and how it's important and for public health infrastructure. And so wetlands are the natural public health infrastructure.
I think this was a very inspiring and perfect closing comment. You were a fabulous podcast guest, Dr. Musonda Mumba. Thank you very much. And in the spirit of collaboration, I hope that also the two of us will stay connected and find ways how to collaborate. It was a real
Absolutely.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much, Andrea. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There, you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.